Matthew's Gospel, and it's chapter 27, verses 45 to 54. From the sixth hour until the ninth hour, darkness came over all the land. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those standing there heard this, they said, "He's calling Elijah." Immediately one of them ran and got a sponge. He filled it with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. The rest said, "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him." And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rocks split. The tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs. And after Jesus' resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many people. When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely he was the Son of God." The question I want to consider just briefly with you this lunchtime is, why did Jesus die? If you know much about this event, you'll know that it's historically true. Not only do the gospel writers in the Bible record his death, but non-Christian writers of the time, like Josephus, record that Jesus was executed in the reign of Pontius Pilate. Moreover, we know that this death of Jesus had been promised for centuries in the Old Testament part of the Bible. There are various things described here which had been predicted centuries beforehand. It's very interesting to think about that. For example, the darkness, which is referred to in little number 45 at the top there, verse 45, there's darkness that came over all the land of Judea in southern Israel. That darkness had been promised centuries earlier. The prophet Joel spoke of a day of terror when darkness would come across the land. The prophet Amos spoke of a day of God's punishment and judgment when darkness would come upon the land. And the prophet Isaiah promised that when darkness came upon the land, God would punish the sin of the world. So this day of darkness, a terrible day of God's judgment, had been promised centuries earlier. Then again, you'll find that this reference to the vinegar in verse 48 being offered to Jesus. Psalm 69, written 1,000 years beforehand, had spoken about God's king being offered vinegar at a time of his shame and disgrace. And then this cry in verse 46 here, my God, why have you forsaken me? That was promised in Psalm 22. Well, Jesus is actually quoting the first line of that psalm. But let me read you some other parts of that psalm which you may not be so familiar with. The writer wrote, "A band of evil men has encircled me. They've pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments amongst them and cast lots for my clothing." So these details of being pierced through hands and feet, of people gambling for the clothes, of his bones not being broken but being mocked by the crowd, though written centuries earlier, all came true on this day in the first century when Jesus was crucified. It's very interesting, isn't it? We know it's historically true, and we know that it had been promised for centuries, but it still leaves open the question, why? Why would God's King, Jesus, die on a cross? Why could it have happened? I think if you ask most people today, people would say it was a rather sort of sad end to a revolutionary figure. I noticed in the Times today, I don't know if you read this, a rebel leader is captured. The rebel movement in Sierra Leone suffered a devastating blow yesterday when its leader, Fode Sanko, was captured stripped naked and marched through Freetown as people danced on his clothes. He was under British guard at Lungi Airport last night. You'll have seen the news, you know that happened. Well, that's what it would have felt like on that day when Jesus died. You could just change some of the words. The Christian rebel movement in Jerusalem suffered a devastating blow yesterday when its leader, Jesus Christ, was captured and marched through Jerusalem as people danced on his clothes. He was under Roman guard just outside Jerusalem last night. Very similar. And I reckon that's how most people think of the death of Jesus. A revolutionary moral figure. Some would be more sympathetic and say it was a tragic end to a great and promising life. a miscarriage of justice, but that's all it was. Well, in this reading here, the writer, Matthew, wants to make clear that there's more to it than that. The reason this death had been promised for centuries is that on that cross, Jesus allowed himself to be captured and killed for a very great reason. And I put it here on the sheet for you. He suffered what we deserve. That the reason that the great transcendent almighty God shrunk himself to an ordinary human being was that in order to suffer what ordinary human beings like us actually deserve. You see, when he cries out here, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's saying, my God, why have you rejected and thrown me out? Why have you abandoned me? So that deep in his soul, he knew what it was to be away from all the good things of God. He'd been thrown out of God's presence. And the reason he went through that experience was that it's what we deserve from God. Now, if you're new to these things, you may well be saying in your heart, I don't deserve that, you know. Why would I deserve to be thrown out of God's presence? What's wrong with me? Who is this bloke saying such rude things? Let me tell you a quick story just to explain what I mean. The reason that we deserve to be thrown out of God's presence is because every single one of us is a sinner. Now, you've heard that word before. It's got all sorts of strange connotations with it. Let me explain what sin really is. Imagine for a moment a small law firm with a partner and a couple of junior assistants who are hoping for promotion to partnership one day. The senior partner explains to the two people, Janet and John, they come into his office one day and he says, look, I'm off to America for 6 months, and while I'm away, I'd like you to run the business for me, and you can have completely the free run of the business. You know, the finances are all yours, you're in charge, and while I'm away, the only thing is, I'd like to keep in touch with you, answer my emails, you know, let's keep in touch on the phone, but the business is yours, show me what you can do with it, and I'll come back in 6 months. So off went the partner, and the junior assistants get on with their work. Now, they are completely different, okay? Janet is a real party animal. And she goes mad. I mean, she comes in late every morning. She's obviously been up all night raving. She's drunk and all the rest of it. She goes home really, really early, and in between she has long lunches. And so she's hardly ever there, and when she is there, she seems to be borrowing funds, and basically she's a complete disgrace. And everybody can see that when the partner returns, Janet's going to be out on her ear. Okay, maybe you know some. Maybe you are somebody like that. Now, John's completely different. All right, John is really tidy, you know, shines the gold buckles on his shoes, little labels on his CDs in the office, you know. He's really, really tidy. He's punctual. He's there early. There all day. He's so neat and tidy. Everybody thinks he's absolutely marvelous, and that when the boss returns, he'll be immediately made up to partnership. So 6 months went by, and home comes the partner. You know what happens? He sacked them both. Now, everybody can understand Janet being chucked out. She made a complete disgrace of herself. But John, he was so tidy and nice, and on the outside, he's so respectable. But what they didn't realize was that in their hearts, Janet and John were the same. They both thought the boss was an idiot. They both thought they could run the business a lot better without him. They just expressed it in different ways. Neither of them bothered to keep in contact with their boss while he was away. They ignored his emails and ran their business the way they wanted to. One looked a mess, the other looked so respectable, but in their hearts, they were both scornful and rebellious against their boss. Now, I tell that story because it illustrates the different ways in which we treat God. You see, whoever we are, wherever we come from, in our hearts, we've got this natural rebellion and scorn for God. We think he's an idiot. We think we can run our lives better without him. And while he's away, we can't really be bothered to keep in touch with him, except when we need help. You know, I'll help you pass this exam, I'll be a missionary. You know, and then the exam goes by and somehow it gets forgotten. You know that? And we're still here. Okay, God just gets scorned and ignored. And it's no surprise that God says, look, when I come back, whether you've trashed your life and it's obvious you're a disgrace, or whether you're very tidy and respectable, I don't care what you look like on the inside. If you've rebelled against me, if you've spent your whole life sticking your fingers in my eyes and saying, push off, leave me alone, when I return, I will throw you out. Now, the Bible's quite plain about that, But that is what we deserve for the way we treat God. So why on earth was Jesus Christ being treated like that, since he's the only man that ever lived who didn't treat God like that? See, Jesus was so close to his Father all his life. Why was he being thrown out? Why was he forsaken on the cross? And the answer is, because he swapped places with you and me. With any of us who believe in him, he has swapped places with us on that cross. Now, the day we realize that is a very, very special day. When we suddenly realize that Jesus Christ wasn't dying for some sort of, you know, great moral example. Oh, look how wonderful I can die. That he was dying in our place so that we don't have to suffer what he suffered for us. Let me illustrate that. You'll remember that head teacher, Philip Lawrence, do you remember a couple of years ago now? There was a head teacher who came out of a London school to find some of the kids from his school were being set upon by a gang. Do you remember that? And he got stabbed in the process and he died. And his wife has set up a memorial fund and so on. Now, you know, on that day, the boys' attitude to their headmaster changed dramatically, didn't it? There are a couple of lads walking around London today, I guess, who know that they're alive today because their headmaster, Philip Lawrence, died for them. Now, before that day, I'll bet you they never thought too much of the headmaster. It's not very common, is it, for teenage boys to have posters of their headmasters on their bedroom ceilings. You know, it doesn't sort of, you know, headmaster, oh, I love him. It's not normal. And if you've got boys like that, see a doctor. Right? It's not normal. But you see, after that day, it all changed. Because on that day, that headmaster died in their place so that they could live. Now, a Christian is somebody who realizes that on that day, a couple of thousand years ago, Jesus Christ, God in human flesh, shrunk to become an ordinary bloke like we are, took our place and suffered what we deserve. Why? Because he loves us. Because he loves us. Now the writer goes on to show what the three effects of that are. Very, very briefly. I put them on the sheet for you here. The effects of this are firstly to give us access to God. See verse 51? At that moment the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Let me explain. Jerusalem, big temple, in the middle, big curtain. Okay, gorgeous curtain, very beautiful, 80 feet high, one piece of material. Although it looked beautiful, it was a terrifying barrier. Because what it represented was that behind it, there was God, and outside it was humanity. And there's a massive, great, big barrier between God and the rest of us. Because we've rebelled against him. We've so offended him. But you see, when Christ suffered the punishment due to us, okay, God has nothing left against us. It's all been dealt with. That's why God sent Jesus to deal with the barrier. And so the barrier tore from top to bottom and opened up the way into God's presence. Do you remember the 11th of November 1989? And what you were doing on that day? When the Berlin Wall was broken down. Do you remember that great symbol of the Cold War between East and West, that great barrier? Do you remember when it's broken down to end the Cold War? Well, in the same way, you see, when that curtain was torn from top to bottom, the Cold War between God and us ended. Right? The barriers are down. There is nothing in the way now to prevent us having a friendship with God. Oh, I know the priests, oh, they all ran out, you see, they looked out in fear from behind the pillars, and then they rushed out, got their Singer sewing machine, and sewed it up again, and tried to pretend the barrier's still there. And you'll find there are people who are still doing that today, with priests and temples everywhere, saying, oh, a barrier between us and God, you know, we can't come close to God, rubbish. On that day, it got torn from top to bottom, and the way is open. That's the first thing, access to God. Any single one of us can have a friendship with God because Christ died. Secondly, verses 52 to 53, to give us life with God. It's very strange this, isn't it? 52, the tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who died were raised to life. Wonder who they were. Perhaps they've been dead for centuries. Absolutely amazing events going on when Jesus died. Well, this is to show, you see, that when Jesus died on the cross, the power of death was broken once and for all. I mean, these people obviously came to life and then died later on. But you see, because death is part of God's judgment on us, because we've rebelled against him. When that judgment was taken by Christ on the cross, it means that the hold of death upon us was broken. So that when we're raised to life, all of us one day to face God, I don't know when it'll be, when we're all raised to life to face him, because of Christ's death on the cross, taking away the judgment we deserve, whoever trusts in that, whoever's standing on his death, will be safe from his judgment then and can live forevermore in God's presence. See, Christ's death took the judgment away, which means that when we die, we will all one day rise to life. And if we've stood on that cross, then we'll be safe with him forever. Let me explain that. I've made that complicated, haven't I? You know, in Australia, you get bushfires sometimes. Yeah, big bushfires sweeping across mountain ranges, consuming, you know, inferno, travelling 50 miles an hour, can't get away. You know that thing? Do you know the only way to escape from a bushfire? Yeah, when the whole mountain range is consumed in flames, the only way to escape is to start a fire. You start a fire. You see, if you start a fire where you are and let the wind blow it, and it burns an area, once it's burnt, you then go and stand in the burnt area, so when the flames come along, they go around the burnt area and you're safe. Okay? Because Christ died and suffered the judgment due to us, okay, if we stand on him, if we depend upon his death in our place, then when we face God on judgment day one day, it'll all go around us and we'll be safe. Because Jesus has already suffered it for us. Therefore, we can live forevermore with him. And that's what's symbolized by these people coming to life. Thirdly and lastly, to give us knowledge of God. 54. When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw all this, they were terrified and exclaimed, "Oh no, surely he was the Son of God." Imagine that. Imagine being a Roman soldier. And suddenly you see everything that happens, and you hear what Jesus says on the cross, and it suddenly hits you. You've just driven stakes through the Son of God. What a terrifying thing to realize that you've done the most dreadful thing and you've got rid of Jesus. Thankfully he hadn't and he came back to life. But they were frightened. It is frightening to discover, isn't it? You've been on the wrong side of God the whole time. You see, this is not the way we would imagine God, would it? We imagine God to be an impersonal sort of force, don't we? You know, Star Wars, may the force be with you. You know, it's the sort of Buddhist inner self. You know, if you meditate and search within you, you find God. Which is very convenient because you see, inside us, of course, that's where we are. So, if we find us, then he's God. That's great, very convenient. Or else, if he's not the inner sort of force within us, he's the transcendent, faraway God. We don't really know he's mysterious and nobody knows what he's like. That's the Muslim God, isn't he? Far, far away. Who knows what whether we'll be forgiven or not, we don't know. Or perhaps in the West, most common of all, is the mythical Father Christmas God. You know, harmless chap. You know, nice bloke, but who cares? Doesn't matter. Now, here we see that God is actually a loving God. A God who sacrifices himself in our place on the cross because he loves us. So these three things are the effect of Jesus swapping place with us. Reconciliation. Access to God. Regeneration. Life forever with God. Revelation. The knowledge of what God's really like. It all becomes clear at the cross. Imagine the Creator is like this. But I wonder whether you can answer that question now then. Why? Why have you forsaken me? Why have you forsaken me in verse 46? Shall I tell you why Jesus was forsaken on that cross? For me. And for you. On that cross, Jesus suffered what you and I deserve because he loves you. And if you want to begin access to God, a new relationship with him, you want to have life with him, a life that goes on beyond the grave forever, if you want to know about him, then you need to start depending upon that cross.